I'm Christopher Lydon in my living room again with a group of friends drinking wine and reading Chekhov, the great short story writer of Russia, of the world. We love him for so many reasons, including the fact that he invites us to digress. We're going to read a famous story called The Student. It's over before it begins. It's a late winter, early spring night, Easter weekend. A student is coming home from shooting, and he tells a story. Chekhov liked to say this was his favorite story. A lot of people disagreed with him, somewhat vehemently. I think he liked to say it because it ends on a very, very exalted note, as if to answer the people who thought he was desperately gloomy and dark and atheistic. He may have said that as a sort of sop to his critics. I don't know. It is, for me, not only the most postage stamp-sized little dose of Chekhov, but it is a very, very beautiful scene. So let's plunge. First, everybody, introduce yourself in a phrase or two, and we'll get going.
My name is Daniel Pritchard. I'm a poet, the marketing director at Boston Review, and the editor of The Critical Flame.
I'm Sarah Barton. I'm a librarian by day and an actress by night.
I'm Ken Cheeseman. I'm an actor and an artist in residence at Emerson College.
Donna Sorbello. I'm an actress and a writer and an instructor of theater.
In my living room with the readers is our own Greek chorus of friends and listeners, including a special guest from Siberia. They're invited to jump in with observations, too. This is The Student from 1894. Chekhov was 34 years old. He had 10 years to live. At first, the weather was fine, still. Blackbirds called, and in the nearby swamp, something alive hooted plaintively as if blowing into an empty bottle. A woodcock chirred by, and a shot rang out boomingly and merrily in the spring air. But when the forest grew dark, an unwelcome east wind blew up, cold and piercing, and everything fell silent. Needles of ice reached over the puddles, and the forest became inhospitable, forsaken, desolate. It felt like winter. Ivan Velikopolsky, a seminary student, son of a verger, was coming home from fowling along a path that went all the way across a water meadow. His fingers were numb, and his face was burned by the wind. It seemed to him that this sudden onset of cold violated the order and harmony of everything, that nature herself felt dismayed. And therefore the evening darkness fell more quickly than it should. It was deserted around him and somehow especially gloomy. Only by the widow's gardens near the river was there a light burning, but far around and where the village lay, some 2 miles off, everything was completely drowned in the cold evening darkness. The student remembered that when he left the house, his mother was sitting on the floor in the front hall, barefoot, polishing the samovar, and his father was lying on the stove and coughing. Because it was Good Friday, there was no cooking in the house, and he was painfully hungry. And now, hunching up from the cold, the student thought how exactly the same wind had blown in the time of Rurik, and of Ivan the Terrible, and of Peter. And in their time there had been the same savage poverty and hunger, the same leaky thatched roofs, ignorance and anguish, the same surrounding emptiness and darkness, the sense of oppression. All these horrors had been and were and would be, and when another 1,000 years had passed, life would be no better. And he did not want to go home.
The widow's gardens were so called because they were kept by two widows, a mother and a daughter. There a wood fire was crackling and blazing, throwing a great circle of light over the plowed earth. The widow Vasilisa, a huge, bloated old woman, was wearing a man's coat. She stood gazing dreamily at the flames, while her daughter Lukeria, a little pockmarked woman with a stupid expression, sat on the ground washing a kettle and some spoons. Apparently they had just finished supper. Men's voices could be heard. They were the local farm workers watering their horses at the river. "Well, winter's back again," the student said, going up to the fire. "Good day to you." Vasilisa gave a start, but she recognized him and smiled at him warmly. "I did not recognize you at first," she said. "God bless you. You'll be rich one day." They went on talking. Vasilisa was a woman of experience. She had served the gentry, first as a wet nurse and then as a children's nurse, and she expressed herself with refinement. A grave and gentle smile never left her lips. Her daughter Luceria was a peasant. The life had been crushed out of her by her husband. She screwed up her eyes at the student and said nothing. She had a strange expression, like that of a deaf mute. On just such a cold night as this, St. Peter warmed himself by a fire, the student said, stretching his hands over the flames. So it must have been very cold. What a terrible night, eh? Yes, it was an extraordinarily long, sad night.
He looked around at the darkness, shook his head convulsively, and asked, I expect you've been to the 12 Gospels? I have, replied Vasilisa. At the time of the Last Supper, you remember, Peter said to Jesus, I am ready to go with you, both into prison and to death. And the Lord said to him, I tell you, Peter, the cock will not crow this day before you deny me three times that you know me. After the supper, Jesus was praying in the garden, sorrowful unto death, and poor Peter was worn out in his soul. He grew weak, his eyes were heavy, and he could not fight off his sleeplessness. He slept. Then that same night, as you heard, Judas kissed Jesus and betrayed him to the executioners. He was bound and led to the high priest and was beaten, and Peter, exhausted, suffered in sorrow and anguish, you see, not having had enough sleep, sensing that something terrible was about to happen on earth, followed after him. He loved Jesus passionately, to distraction, and now from afar he saw how they beat him. Luceria abandoned the spoons and turned her fixed gaze on the student. They came to the high priest, he went on. Jesus was questioned, and the servants meanwhile made a fire in the courtyard because it was cold, and they warmed themselves. Peter stood by the fire with them and also warmed himself, as I'm doing now. A woman saw him and said, This man was also with Jesus, meaning that he, too, should be taken and questioned. And all the servants who were by the fire must have looked at him suspiciously and sternly, because he became confused and said, I do not know the man. A little later, someone recognized him as one of Jesus' disciples and said, You are one of them. But he denied it again. And a third time, someone turned to him, Did I not see you today in the garden with him? A third time he denied it, and right after that the cock crowed, and Peter, looking at Jesus from afar, remembered the word he had said to him at the supper, remembered, recovered, went out of the courtyard, and wept bitterly. The gospel says, and he went out and wept bitterly. I picture it a very, very silent and dark garden, and barely heard in the distance a muffled sobbing.
The student sighed and fell to thinking. Still smiling, Vasilisa suddenly choked, and big, abundant tears rolled down her cheeks. She shielded her face from the fire with her sleeve, as if ashamed of her tears, and Luceria, gazing fixedly at the student, flushed, and her expression became heavy, strained, as in someone who is trying to suppress intense pain. The laborers were coming back from the river, and one of them, on horseback, was already close, and the light of the fire wavered on him. The student wished the widows good night and went on, and again it was dark, and his hands were cold. A cruel wind was blowing, and winter was indeed coming back, and it did not seem that in 2 days it would be Easter. Now the student was thinking about Vasilisa. If she wept, it meant that everything that had happened with Peter on that dreadful night had some relation to her. He looked back. The solitary fire flickered peacefully in the darkness, and the people around it could no longer be seen. The student thought again that if Vasilisa wept and her daughter was troubled, then obviously what he had just told them, something that had taken place 19 centuries ago, had a relation to the present. To both women, and probably to this desolate village, to himself, to all people. If the old woman wept, it was not because he was able to tell it movingly, but because Peter was close to her and she was interested with her whole being in what had happened in Peter's soul.
And joy suddenly stirred in his soul, and he even stopped for a moment to catch his breath. The past, he thought, is connected with the present in an unbroken chain of events, flowing one out of the other. And it seemed to him that he had just seen both ends of that chain. He touched one end, and the other moved. And when he crossed the river on the ferry, and then, going up the hill, looked at his native village and to the west, where a narrow strip of cold, crimson sunset shone, he kept thinking how the truth and beauty that had guided human life there in the garden and in the high priest's courtyard went on unbroken to this day, and evidently had always been the main thing in human life and generally on earth. And a feeling of youth, health, strength. He was only 22, and an inexpressibly sweet anticipation of happiness, an unknown, mysterious happiness, gradually came over him, and life seemed to him delightful, wondrous, and filled with lofty meaning. April, 1894.
You were speaking about happiness in another story, happenings.
Yes. This thing of being in one place, touching the chain, feeling it go back. I just was with my mother-in-law, and we share a birthday, and she just turned 92. And a friend of mine, when he has his seders, he'll bring up a thing of like, who's the oldest person here at the seder? And I was thinking, if she were at that seder and she was 92... And then you go, who's the youngest person at the Seder? And you roll it back. You can roll it back, and it's only like 25, 30 people who are 92. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's not that many human lives, in a way, that are between these events that he's talking about. It's, you know, 20 lives. You know, people can live to be 92, 100 years of age, 19 centuries.
But it's also a kind of version of the processes of nature.
Right.
Endless succession, except in this case, it's very human. It's a succession of truth and beauty that guide right. human life. And it's unbroken to this day over 20 centuries. Only 19 people of 100 years old sort of passing the baton
right.
gets you from Peter in the garden to the student at the river.
Yeah.
But to me, the big mystery of this story, and it's like other stories we've read of Chekhov, is why suddenly, from the story of a betrayal that endlessly recycles itself in human conversation and it brings tears to these peasant women, why that suddenly turns to joy in his soul on this dark, bleak night.
That's Christian redemption.
Yeah.
That's the heart of Christian redemption. Christ went willingly to die, and we all live in the joy and peace of it.
And that Peter loved him for all his sin. He loved him overwhelmingly and cried bitterly.
It's sort of hard to wrap your mind around in the modern age, when God is dead, etc. But the 19th century was steeped in this. I mean, this was the central battle of that time was the aristocracy's relationship to God, the peasant's relationship to God, the meaning of Christianity and Christendom after the many schisms and splits and wars. And I mean, this is quite central to their mindset. And it's a contradiction. It's a great, great contradiction that really puzzled theologians all the way back.
Which contradiction?
The contradiction of joy out of death, joy out of sorrow, of redemption through pain and suffering. We see life through pain. We see life through death.
I have a feeling that this notion of redemption has these sort of, you know, what links us, these you know, connective qualities, because, of course, you know, it touches on the idea of, you know, human weakness. Apostle Peter himself had flaws, just like all of us do, but he, you know, turned out being one of the greatest of saints. And I think when he finds out that these stories of how everything is connected, I mean, I don't want to bring out this whole universal entanglement, but now we know that if we split an atom, if you take one to the edge of the universe and the other to the next, the moment you touch the link, the other chain moves. This whole notion of oneness with everything and connectedness. So I think these beautiful writers kind of knew that before science was somehow able to prove this. This notion of being one with nature and also, you know, human weakness and how redemption links us.
Chekhov has chosen the Christian story, and I'm sure there's great meaning in that, and he's selected it for a reason. But I think it really, for me, it has to do with the depth of feeling. He could have told any story that would have made those women react, and I think it could have had the same ending. I think it's the depth of humanity is such that everybody feels these great feelings, these enormous feelings that sustain, you know, from the past to the present, and it's such a universal feeling, and that he's connected to that. That's for me how it works.
Sure. How do you move the chain, right? How do you move the chain? He tells the story. Art moves the chain.
Interesting.
Art is what connects us. That everything is connected, but it's totally invisible unless you have the power to touch one end and make the other end move. And you do that with art, with narrative.
And when you can change people's hearts, then you can change society, which is what was bothering him before he goes to the fire, that, you know, it's cold and these people are carrying on, nothing is going to change. But if the story of Peter moves these two women, you know, Peter lived in Palestine, they lived in Russia, there's all this time between them. If this man who's so far away in time and space, if his story can touch their hearts until they weep, who knows what else this young man can do with his education?
One little detail fascinates me. That picture at the beginning of his mother back home is barefoot, polishing the samovar, and his father is lying on the stove. I always wonder, is he drunk out of his mind? Is he desperately cold or what? What does that mean, lying on the stove?
He's painfully hungry.
He's hungry.
The student is painfully hungry, but the people all around him are in misery.
Siberia, tell us what you think.
No, it was just a normal thing to lay on a stove. You know, he would just could be lazy, you know, and just think about life. Mm. We have this famous character who lay on the stove for 33 years, and he's considered, like, doing nothing, and then he achieved the most in life. So that's a famous story, you know.
What does the story mean?
It means that you can just contemplate about life and then be ahead of the game instead of toiling every day, you know.
Well, I just took it as a picture of utter besotted misery and loss in a scene that the student thinks is not never going to change. It's the same in the time of Rurik. It'll be the same 1,000 years from now. And from there, the turn to this almost inexpressible joy. Life seemed to him at the end delightful, wondrous, and filled with lofty meaning. Thank you, Niazi. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Anton Chekhov. We'll do it again. We've been reading from the Norton edition of Chekhov Stories. Marion Feld did our translation of The Student. Thanks to Yo-Yo Ma for his version of the Rococo Variations composed by Chekhov's friend Tchaikovsky. Special thanks to the audio pro on so many stages, Jim Donahue, who wired us all for sound. Listeners out there, we'll be delighted to hear your take on this story, The Student, and on our cult of the great Anton Chekhov. We'll be starting a new season of Stories any day now. Mary McGrath is producer and editor of this podcast series. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Reading Chekhov Project, and do pass it on.
Thank you.